bloodshed, he have that time also elections. Saddam Hussein, he was having some elections. Many of countries, a dictatorship country, who they imprisoned their people, they use election. But
so you're saying the elections are not real?
It's fake. It's fake, exactly. It's not real election. Means there is many aspect that we can prove that this election doesn't represent a vote of Bahrainian people. That's why they came with that election. It's they use it as a makeup. The election, they use it as a makeup to beauty the ugly face of this dictatorship government.
Your final words. We know that there's an international conference that King Hamad is sponsoring that's coming up in November, and even the Pope is supposed to be there and other people. What would be your message to those individuals going to Bahrain for this conference?
First, my message for the Pope itself, because he is the top of this group who's coming in Bahrain, and he should know that by his visit to Bahrain, he is, if he mean or he doesn't mean, he is going to support this dictatorship government against his nation. And that's not the message of the Catholic Vatican. It's not the message. They said we are following the Christian and we are following Jesus. Jesus will not agree to be against one person in this world. How about nation or how about a country full of people? So that will not be acceptable. He is representing today the Pope. He is representing Jesus. And we don't believe that if Jesus was in this world, will visit Bahrain by even the call of his ruling government.
Right. Well, I would love to continue talking to you, but we're out of time. I appreciate you so much for being with us here on Hidden Files.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Stay with us. I'll be right back with more of the show. As there are growing calls from Bahrainis for external pressure to be applied on the regime, the Al Khalifa family continue to work towards trying to show that everything is normal inside of the country. The regime's Western allies seem to continue to turn a blind eye to the oppression that is taking place. This is despite the United States having its fifth fleet stationed in Bahrain. So the Americans are quite aware of what is happening on the island nation. And of course, with both the United States and the United Kingdom, what we have seen is continued support for the regime and increased weapon sales to facilitate Hamad and company with its iron fist policy. And then there's Israel, and that the regime has normalized ties with the Israelis, despite the majority of Bahrainis being against the normalization of ties. Now, there's Saudi Arabia, which continues to support the regime and wants to help it change the demography of the small island nation so that the voices that may still be heard may become even more stifled. Well, perhaps participants in the upcoming conference being held in Bahrain, according to some in exile, to whitewash the reality on the ground, can serve as a forum for those who really want the truth to demand accountability. How about a visit with political prisoners to see their overall conditions? How about demanding that before Hamad reaches out to the East and the West, he reaches out to his own people and allow them to have fair representation and participation in the society? How about releasing political prisoners? How about reinstating the citizenship of so many people? How about letting the Bahraini people breathe? One person, one vote, and then watch how Bahrain could flourish if the people were given a chance to choose its own course. Well, we're hoping that eventually that will be the case, and we're keeping our eyes on Bahrain, and we're bringing you all the latest on this continued demand to end the oppression in this country. Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of Hidden Files. Make sure you join us next week and see where our files will take us to. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Economic recession and inflation, high cost of living and poor performance of the government all means that the British people are facing difficulties with their current living conditions. This has prompted labour unions, students, nurses and young people to go on strike against the current situation. The British protesters say it's all the result of more than a decade of conservative rule, and the time has come for a change. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Forbes magazine has more for us. Britain's beleaguered health services face yet another blow as the country's main nursing union looks to have voted in favour of industrial action. The Royal College of Nursing asked its 300,000 members to strike over pay in a ballot that ended recently. Although official results have not yet been announced, sources have told several UK publications nurses have largely agreed to the industrial action. If a strike goes ahead, it will be the first ever walkout of its kind. The move would put extra pressure on already intensely overstretched health services, exacerbating twin crises in emergency and non-urgent care. As hospitals struggle to get on top of lengthy waiting lists, a strike would likely lead to further cancellations of appointments. But union leaders say nurses in emergency care would continue to work if industrial action goes ahead. This includes those working in life-preserving services like critical care, continuing therapeutic care, and urgent diagnostics. The Royal College of Nursing wants to strike over what it argues are inadequate pay rises offered by the government earlier this year. Union leaders argued the rising cost of living in the United Kingdom dwarfs the salary boosts offered to nurses who have endured extremely challenging working conditions throughout the pandemic. The government says that a nurse's average basic salary would rise from roughly £35,600 to £37,000 from March of this year. This is an increase of about 4%. But union leaders have asked for a much larger increase that takes into account soaring levels of inflation. They want a pay rise of 5% above inflation, which currently stands at around 13%. Union leaders say pay increases are needed not just to help nurses battle the cost of living crisis, but to make the overall workforce itself more resilient. Britain's hospitals are seriously understaffed, with tens of thousands of nursing vacancies currently unfilled. Other major health unions, including Unison, are also considering industrial action over pay. The Royal College of Nursing General Secretary and Chief Executive, Pat Cullen, said in a statement, "Patients are at great risk when there aren't enough nurses. Huge numbers of staff, both experienced and new recruits, are deciding they cannot see a future in the nursing profession and that is not valued nor treated fairly. Our strike action will be as much for patients as it is for nurses. We have their support in doing this. As we begin industrial action, politicians in every part of the United Kingdom will be challenged to back their nursing staff and understand the strength of public support." The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. Britain's University and College Union, UCU, said on Tuesday, 8th of November, over 70,000 university staff will go on strike action in the coming days over pay, working conditions and pensions. Britain's University and College Union, UCU, said the strikes will be held on 24th, 25th and 30th of November, with staff at 150 universities across the United Kingdom taking part in the walkouts. The University and College Union General Secretary Joe Grady said in a statement on the union's website, "Campuses across the United Kingdom about to experience strike action on a scale never seen before." Joe Grady noted, 70,000 staff will walk out and make clear they refuse to accept falling pay, cuts to pensions and insecure employment. "This is not a dispute about affordability, it is about choices. Vice Chancellors are choosing to pay themselves hundreds of thousands of pounds whilst forcing our members onto low-paid and insecure contracts that leave some using food banks. They choose to hold billions in surpluses whilst slashing staff pensions." The strikes are expected to lead to the cancellation of lectures and disruption to courses for nearly 2.5 million university students. However, the union said disruption can be avoided if employers act fast and make improved offers. If they don't, strike action will escalate in the new year alongside a marking and assessment boycott. The University and College Union demands a pay rise due to the cost of living crisis, following the offer of a pay increase starting at 3% and an end to insecure contracts. The union also wants a reversal of cuts to sector pensions imposed this year, which it says will see the average member lose around 35% from future retirement income. The British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. According to the City Watchdog, which said a growing proportion of the UK's population is having trouble making ends meet, millions of people are also struggling to pay their bills. A survey by the Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, laid bare the impact of the cost of living crisis in Britain, saying about 1 in 4 or 24% of adults in the United Kingdom were either in financial difficulty or would fall into trouble if they suffered a financial shock. The Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, found that about 7.8 million people were finding it a heavy burden to keep up with their bills, an increase of about 2.5 million people since 2020. As wage growth failed to keep pace with soaring inflation, which is currently at a 40-year high, currently at 10.1%. Meanwhile, 4.2 million people had missed bills or loan payments in the 6 months before the survey took place, in the 4 months between February and June of this year. The financial challenges were concentrated in more deprived areas across the United Kingdom, with people in economically challenged regions roughly 7 times more likely to be in financial difficulty than their peers elsewhere. About 12% of people in the northeast of England and 10% in the northwest of England were struggling financially, compared with 6% of people in the southeast of England and in the southwest of England. The statistics were gathered as part of the FCA's Financial Lives Survey, which polled more than 19,000 people and will be published in full in early 2023. The government is believed to be considering raising benefits in line with wage growth of 5.5% rather than inflation, which would put further pressure on already struggling households. The Resolution Foundation think tank has said it would have stark consequences for families, with a single disabled adult on universal credit likely to lose £380, while a working single parent with one child would lose £478 a year. A working couple with 3 children would lose £978 a year. Sheldon Mills, a director overseeing consumer and competition issues at the Financial Conduct Authority, said, "Our research shows that people up and down the country are struggling to keep up with their bills. If you're facing financial difficulty, you do not need to struggle alone. There is free debt advice available, and we have told firms they must work with their customers to solve any problems with payments."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
From the insurrection in the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, to block the certification of the presidential election results to the October 28 attack on U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's home, these incidents are among the most high-profile instances of political violence in America in recent times. Now, many believe the problem has gone from bad to worse in recent weeks. Harassment of political candidates and voter intimidation have been reported in many parts of the country, prompting some local authorities to elevate vigilance on Election Day. Also, threats against members of Congress are up tenfold. According to Capitol Police, more than 9,600 threats against members of Congress were recorded last year. Threats against federal judges have spiked 400% in the past 6 years to more than 4,200 in 2021. Also, election poll workers have received hundreds of violent threats, leading many to resign from their positions and discouraging others from volunteering in first place. Analysts believe the current trend of increased threats to lawmakers and election officials, extremist candidates running for office, disinformation and heated rhetoric are raising the risk of domestic terrorism and other forms of extreme violence in the United States. That's why a new survey suggests that almost 1 in 5 Americans agree that violence is sometimes needed to protect democracy when elected leaders will not. Therefore, U.S. politics is now in danger of spilling over into street violence. as an answer to unwanted results. Nearly 9 in 10 Americans are concerned that political divisions have intensified to the point that there is a risk of politically motivated violence in the United States. And the 2022 midterm elections could act as a catalyst for future domestic extremist violence in the U.S. U.S. President Joe Biden has sounded the alarm over threats to democracy in his closing arguments ahead of the midterm elections.
Democracy is on the ballot. Political violence and intimidation are on the rise all across America. And you remember January 6th, the angry mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol, attacked law enforcement, hunted down elected officials, erected gallows to hang Vice President Pence. Well, West's opponent supported that mob. Who the hell do they think they are?
Biden has called on Americans to accept the election results and avoid resorting to violence. Also, former U.S. President Donald Trump said he's expecting a Republican victory in the elections. Trump has also vowed to make a big announcement next week, hinting that he's going to run for the 2024 presidential election.
This is the year we're going to take back the House, we're going to take back the Senate, and we're going to take back America. And in 2024, most importantly, we are going to take back our magnificent White House. I'm going to be making a very big announcement on Tuesday, November 15th, at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida.
The 2022 midterm elections are the first vote since the January 6th Capitol riot. Democrats have been campaigning around what they call the threat a Republican win would pose to U.S. democracy. Republicans, however, have focused their campaign on such issues as soaring inflation and the scale of violent crimes. Dozens of Republican candidates who could be elected as governors or elected administrators in key states have also echoed Trump's claims of fraud in his 2020 presidential election defeat. Election forecasters predicted that Republicans are likely to pick up roughly 25 seats in the 435-seat House of Representatives, more than enough to win a majority.
UN's climate change summit, Secretary General Antonio Guterres responded to a UN report released on Sunday by saying that the planet is sending a distress signal.
Greenhouse gas emissions are now on course to rise by 10%. And meanwhile, temperatures are on course to rise by as much as 2.8 degrees with the present policies in place by the end of the century. And that means our planet is on course for reaching tipping points and that will make climate chaos irreversible and forever bake in catastrophic temperature rise. We need to move from tipping points to turning points for hope.
The report had indicated that the past 8 years are said to have had the warmest climates to ever be recorded. The report had also indicated that global temperatures have risen by 1.15 degrees Celsius since the pre-industrial era, catastrophically accelerating rise in sea levels, glacier mass loss, and unprecedented heat waves. World leaders are discussing solutions in Sharm el-Sheikh's Red Sea Resort in Egypt, while the event is hosted by the Egyptian foreign minister, who emphasized on the magnitude of the challenge that now faces the world. The outgoing chair of the talks and British official Alok Sharma mentioned some political reasons as one of the major causes for the impediment of global efforts concerning the environment, specifically the Ukraine war.
War in Ukraine has precipitated multiple global crises: energy and food insecurity, inflationary pressures, and spiraling debt. And these crises have compounded existing climate vulnerabilities and the scarring effects of the pandemic.
But then he went back on the topic of actual climate catastrophes and pointed out the devastating Pakistan and Nigeria floods, as well as unprecedented droughts in Europe, China, and the U.S. Speaking of, U.S. President Joe Biden is expected to attend the event later in the week. He's usually enthusiastic about climate events. After all, it was Biden who got the U.S. back into the Paris Climate Accord after Trump pulled out of it. But apparently, neither his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping nor Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi are expected to attend, with China and India being among the biggest polluters of the world. Their absence has cast much doubt over the effectiveness of any potential deal planned to cut emissions during the summit. The treaty was adopted in 2015 between 196 parties, including the EU, at the UN Climate Change Conference near Paris. It demands a 50% cut in global emissions until the year of 2030 to keep the temperature rises to well below 2 degrees Celsius, preferably below 1.5. The eventual goal is to reach net zero emissions by the middle of the 21st century. The treaty has determined an aggregate contribution for each country in terms of how much they need to cut down on their emissions. The UK is one of the signatories to the accord, and their share of emissions reductions by 2030 is said to be on the higher end of the spectrum. They are expected to cut down on their emissions by 68% by 2030, compared to UK's emissions in 1990. There have been plans set in motion, but in a document presented by the Secretary of State for Business, Energy and Industrial Energy to the Parliament, the war in Ukraine is mentioned as the reason that prompted the UK Prime Minister to do a, quote, independent review of the government's approach to meeting its net zero 2050 target. That independent review turned into a rather counterproductive decision. The UK has reversed its fracking ban as a result of the energy crisis it is currently going through. Fracking, short for hydraulic fracturing, is a process that involves injecting water, chemicals, and sand into the cracks of the earth at high pressure to widen the cracks and allow for extraction of oil and gas, in the case of the UK, only gas, from shale formations. The ban was introduced in 2019 when an earthquake occurred near Britain's only remaining fracking site. Fracking sites are known to release various forms of toxins and pollutants into the air, including chemicals that can cause severe headaches, asthma symptoms, childhood leukemia, cardiac problems, and even birth defects. Among the 1,000-plus chemicals used in fracking, some are even known to cause cancer. But those were only the negative effects of fracking on humans. For the environment, the vast amount of wastewater and greenhouse gases released, such as methane, will cause irreversible harm. The US isn't hit as hard as the EU as a result of the war in Ukraine, so their arms sales that will in effect prolong the war might even have a net positive effect for the country. But the EU that is hurting the most from the war is getting the short end of the stick. They are scrambling for other means of energy procurement, and the US might just be their last resort. A US that has increased its price of gas for an increasingly desperate Europe in dire need of energy, waiting for a difficult winter.
Sirens going off in South Korea. Another salvo of North Korean ballistic missiles fired. This is part of Pyongyang's testing blitz. A new annual record for missile launches was set back in June. And just this week, 23 missiles were launched in a single day, setting a new daily record. U.S. officials have indicated that North Korea is ready to conduct a nuclear test at any time. Let's not forget, these missiles have the ability to reach U.S. soil, specifically California. Meanwhile, Washington and Seoul have conducted their biggest ever Air Force drills. North Korea's firing of intercontinental ballistic missiles and more U.S. war games. A dangerous and volatile concoction, a war scenario which, if it were true, would involve nuclear weapons. That was evident from the U.S. side when the U.S. Air Force deployed the two B-1B long-range heavy bombers on the final day of the military exercises. This was the first time B-1Bs have flown to the Korean Peninsula since December 2017. So why is Pyongyang on the offensive? Even though the missile launches grabbed all the attention, less notice were developments in the North Korean nuclear doctrine. In September, North Korea updated a 2013 law setting out its nuclear weapons policies and announced that it would respond to attacks against its nuclear command and control systems by launching a nuclear strike automatically and immediately.
The fundamental mission of our nuclear forces is to deter a war, but our nukes can never be confined to the single mission of war deterrent. Even at a time when a situation we are not desirous of at all is created on this land.
The U.S. and its allies in this region better be careful. Even an accidental targeting of anything in North Korea could signal a dangerous reaction. And that could spell nuclear Armageddon. North Korea's barrage of missiles is sending the U.S. another message other than military and missile capabilities. North Korea has been under severe U.S. sanctions. For starters, it has sanctioned properties and belongings of the Workers' Party of Korea. Freezing the property of members of the Workers' Party of Korea essentially amounts to stealing from everyday Koreans, as the party's membership stands at 6.5 million people, or a quarter of North Korea's population. Harsh U.S. bilateral and U.N. sanctions have had particularly devastating effects on the North Korean economy. The list of industries directly targeted include the mineral trade, seafood, textiles, and agricultural products. Previous talks between the U.S. and North Korea hinged on the elimination of these sanctions, which turned for Pyongyang to stop its ballistic nuclear program. But the U.S. was not willing to give any concessions, resulting in a stalemate. Meanwhile, the U.S. believes that China and Russia have the leverage to persuade North Korea not to resume nuclear bomb testing. But why should they do that? Given the Ukraine conflict and how U.S. feels about Russia and U.S.'s appetite for confrontation with China, either militarily or when it comes to trade, this idea seems far-fetched. Perhaps a grand bargain can be reached between U.S., Russia, and China when it comes to North Korea, if the desire is there before it is too late. And as far as U.S. foreign policy goes, it has failed in many respects. When it comes to countries like Iran, North Korea, China, Russia, Syria, well, the list is long. The current U.S. President Joe Biden, like many of his predecessors, has failed to execute a clear diplomatic path to reach solutions, opting instead for provocation and military aggression.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan held high-level talks in Tehran following a trilateral meeting with Russian and Azerbaijani leaders on the conflict in the Caucasus region. It was officially received by Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi on Tuesday morning, and the two held talks at the Sarabot Palace in the capital, Tehran. In addition to a bilateral meeting, the two top executive officials held a meeting of high-level delegations, and after attending the signing ceremony of a cooperation document in the field of energy, they elaborated on the results of their consultations in a joint press conference. The Iranian president stated that Pashinyan's visit to Iran will be a turning point in the development of ties between the two neighboring countries.
Neighborhood policy is one of the policies emphasized by the government, and during this administration we had several meetings with Mr. Pashinyan. In these meetings, especially in this particular meeting, the focus of the negotiations was the development of commercial, economic, and security relations between the two countries.
Expressing satisfaction with the growing trends of relations between the two countries, Raisi pointed to the diverse and numerous capacities available in Iran and Armenia, calling for an all-out effort to improve the level of relations and expand bilateral cooperation. The Iranian president pointed to energy cooperation as one of the capacities available to improve the level of relations between the two countries, saying, "The Islamic Republic is ready to expand cooperation in other economic and commercial areas, including in increasing the export of technical and engineering services." Also noting that the Caucasus region is a part of Iran's history, civilization, and culture, Raisi underscored that security and peace in the Caucasus region are very important for Iran. The Iranian president added that negotiations with Pashinyan led to the conclusion that resolving the issues of the region must occur at the hands of officials and authorities of the region, and any interference by foreigners will only create problems rather than solve them. Pashinyan, for his part, appreciated the constructive role of the Islamic Republic in the region and stressed that Iran's efforts have always been aimed at stabilizing and strengthening peace and security in the region. Pashinyan expressed gratitude for the priority given by Raisi's administration to the development of ties with the neighboring countries. The Armenian premier also called for strengthening transit cooperation between the two countries to connect the Black Sea to the Persian Gulf. Iran opened a consulate in the southern Armenian city of Kapan on October 21st, nearly a year after expressing interest in doing so. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian officially inaugurated the consulate. At the opening ceremony, Amir Abdollahian stated that the security of Armenia and the region is Iran's security. He called for the development of north-south transportation corridor through Armenia. He also said Tehran's policies to respect territorial integrity as well as internationally recognized borders. Tehran had previously stated that changes in its borders and transit links with Armenia would be a red line that it would not tolerate being crossed. That's when Turkey and Azerbaijan have been planning to establish a new transport link called the Zangzor Corridor. In case of opening, it will affect Iran-Armenia commerce and could sever a major Iranian transit link with the South Caucasus. Meanwhile, Tehran has not contented itself with only diplomatic messages. The inauguration of the Kapan Consulate came after several days of large-scale military exercises by IRGC near Iran's borders with Azerbaijan. The latest simultaneous diplomatic and defensive moves clearly show the Iranian government is ready to defend its national interests in all seriousness.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith through action. Sunday, the 5th of Ramadan, 1394, the 22nd of September, 1974. In any case, it is over the course of many long years that the enemies have been working on the minds of the Muslims so that they say that Islam is not action. Faith requires no work. As long as there is love and faith and belief in your heart, there is nothing else you need to do. You don't need to move, to strive, to have an effect. It is years that they have been trying to convince of this. But what does the Quran say? It says loud and clear that they do not have faith. The Quran, Surah 24, verse 47. Those people who do not do what these verses describe, which we will continue to discuss tomorrow as well, are not believers. The faithful are those people who are with you, those people who are surrounded by Allah's grace, brotherhood, and submission, who are striving in the way of Allah in a way that befits their beliefs. They strive, they take action. This is the logic of the Quran. O you who have faith, bow down and prostrate yourselves and worship your Lord and do good, so that you may be felicitous. The Quran, Surah 22, verse 77.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If you do these actions, you will be successful, happy, and saved. But if you had faith without bowing, prostrating, worshipping Allah, or doing good, then will you be successful and happy? You can clearly see what the answer is. And strive for the sake of Allah, a striving that is worthy of Him. He has chosen you. The Quran, Surah 22, verse 78. It is He who has chosen you, O community of Islam. What does it mean when the Quran says He has chosen you? Does it mean you have been set aside like precious pearls, that you are cut from different cloth? They sin, they err, they disobey our commands, and paradise has their name on it? This is what the Jews claimed at the time of the Prophet. They made the same mistake. Every Muslim has the same mistaken idea in their head. The Quran responds to the Jews who believe themselves to be God's chosen and beloved, or in fact the sons of God, by delivering a very sharp rebuke. It says that the chosen and beloved of God are those who obey His commands. Yes, O children of Israel, we chose you. God chose the nation of Islam, but before Islam He chose the Israelites. But both acts of choosing are one and the same. In other words, God chose the people best prepared for His most important mission.
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Analysis of recent events in Iran. In this program, we look at women's status within the Islamic Republic of Iran and emphasize the social life of women in the Islamic Republic. We also take a look at Islam's viewpoints about women. Please stay with us. Islam defends women's rights more than other religions. In fact, the prophets and messengers of God, peace be upon them, have always talked about life and freedom. Life and freedom can be thought of as their slogan. The Almighty says in Ayah 24 of Surah Anfal in the Holy Quran, O believers, respond to Allah and His Messenger when He calls you to that which gives you life. And know that Allah stands between a person and their heart, and that to Him you will all be gathered. The Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, used to live in a society which lacked any sort of humanitarian, ethical, and moral values. This is why pre-Islamic Arabs are referred to as Jahiliyyah Arabs. They did not value women, and they even denied women their right to life. In those days in Arabia, it was customary to bury alive newly born female infants. With the emergence of Islam, though, this custom was totally uprooted, and Islam fought this superstition and others like it in all of its manifestations. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was the most staunch supporter of women's rights, and Islam enshrined the most fundamental and the most important right of women, the right to live a full life. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, used to treat his daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, with such great respect and care that everybody was surprised and took note of this. He always used to kiss her hand, and when returning from a journey, the first person he went to see was Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. Similarly, when Prophet Muhammad was about to embark on a journey, the last house he always visited to bid farewell was that of his daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. There are many hadiths or narrations from Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, in which the Holy Prophet calls upon everyone to treat women with respect, with dignity and decency. The Holy Prophet used to say, "The best men of my ummah are those who are most kind to their family members, and those who are not condescending or coarse and harsh towards their family." Other hadiths or narrations relating to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, include the following. "The best of you is he who is best to his wife. Always act kindly towards women. Paradise lies under the feet of the mother." The Holy Prophet, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was asked once, "Whose right was the greatest on man?" The Holy Prophet replied, "His mother's." Modern Western civilization is based upon money and material gain. In Western society, money and wealth are everything. People are allowed to do whatever they like as long as they don't break the laws of the land. Immoral and unethical behavior is allowed so long as no laws are broken. This is a shame, of course, since Islam does not accept immoral and unethical behavior. In fact, Islamic teachings are based on monotheism, morality and ethics, and Islam sets out clear boundaries for freedom, emphasizing that freedom and responsibility go hand in hand. Islam, of course, always emphasizes the importance of human dignity and human honor. False Western slogans of supporting Iranian women's rights is really a pointer to the fact that Westerners are angry and frustrated with Iranian women, who have delivered a severe blow to Western civilization, exposing the fact that Western women are exploited and abused in Western societies. Frustrated with the fact that they are unable to take on the Islamic Republic militarily, the terrorist United States and Israeli regimes have now resorted to a vicious media campaign against Iran, using the pretext of women's rights. No doubt the Iranian nation will emerge triumphant once more from this challenge, successfully overcoming and defeating the hybrid war which is now being waged by the West against Islamic Iran. The duplicitous and deceitful Westerners have falsely claimed that Islam denigrates women and does not value women. They claim that men and women are not equal within Islam. However, the Lord Most High says in Ayah 1 of Surah Nisa in the Holy Quran, "O humanity, be mindful of your Lord, who created you from a single soul, and from it he created its mate. And through both he spread countless men and women. And be mindful of Allah, in whose name you appeal to one another, and honor family ties. Surely Allah is ever watchful over you." According to Islamic teachings, men and women have been created from a single soul. The duties and responsibilities that have been given to them are equal. For example, with regards to daily prayers, with regards to the Hajj pilgrimage, fasting during the holy month of Ramadan, and social responsibilities such as enjoining good and refraining from that which has been prohibited. Both men and women have equal duties and equal responsibilities. According to Islamic teachings, there is no difference between men and women, and both have been endowed with intelligence and human dignity. According to Islam, men and women complement one another and they complete each other. Both men and women can help each other grow and evolve. Both of them are central planks of society and central planks of the family. The Holy Quran teaches us that the value of each human being, both men and women, lies in their piety and abstinence from wrong and sinful behavior. According to the Holy Quran, men and women who are more pious are closer to God and more valued by God. Today, Iranian women are active in all fields of science, technology, economy, business and society, and have excelled in all of these fields.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
With reporters.
Addressing world leaders at the climate summit in Egypt, UN Chief Antonio Guterres says it's a moral imperative for rich countries to help vulnerable countries. Regarding that, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Taliban emphasizes that climate change does not know political borders, and countries which have no role in creating climate crisis have suffered the most damage and should not be ignored.
In recent 4 months, we have witnessed a significant rise in the number of natural disasters in Afghanistan. They include earthquake, flash flood, and drought. According to our assessments, almost 10 million people affected by these disasters need urgent help. We also need international cooperation to deal with impacts of such crises.
Afghanistan emits almost 0.1% of global greenhouse gases. But it is paying the price for growing climate chaos, mostly created by top emitters in the world. The results of climate change, including earthquakes, flash floods, and drought in Afghanistan, drive people towards hunger day by day. OCHA says 97% of Afghans could be too poor to survive without aid by the end of this winter, which shows a 50% rise in 2 years.
I would say 70% of people can't afford their basic needs. People have become poor. It has become much more difficult for many Afghans to buy food. And by winter, the situation would even get worse, I believe.
Previously, we had jobs and we could save for our winter. But now, I work only one day in a 10-day period. Some nights, we only eat bread with tea. we could use the aids if there were any.
According to the United Nations, Afghanistan is the sixth most affected country in the world, enduring the consequences of climate change. Immigration, job losses and cropland destruction are the results of climate change. These problems are aggravated by recent political conflicts and severely impact the country's economy. The devastating results of climate change have added to the problems Afghans are facing. International help for this winter could ease the situation for people already grappling with poverty. Abdullah Hamirzad, Kabul.
Iran has recently unveiled the newest version of its homegrown missile defense system, Bavar 373, which is said to have taken one step closer to the Russian-made S-400 anti-aircraft weapon system. During the test fire, a stationary target was detected at a range of more than 450 kilometers by the optimized radar of the missile system and was tracked at a range of about 405 kilometers and was hit at a range of more than 300 kilometers. The long-range missile has solid fuel and was evaluated during operation for the first time. The detection radar range of the Bavar 373 system has increased from 350 to 450 kilometers, and its engagement radar range has increased from 260 to 400 kilometers. The Bavar 373 long-range air defense system is capable of detecting up to 100 targets, tracking 60 of them and engaging with 6 concurrently.
All air defense systems are divided into 3 main categories based on their missions and operations, including long-range, middle-range, and short-range systems. Bavar 373 is a long-range missile system. Only 4 or 5 countries in the world have the technology to manufacture such a strategically important missile system. These countries do not even allow other countries to master such a technology, and if they provide any country with such a missile system, they will operate and overhaul the systems themselves, and operational and communicational codes are not given to the using country.
A distinguishing feature of Bavar 373 is its vertical launching system with square launchers, mostly used for air defense on warships. The system's missile range has increased from 200 to 300 kilometers, and its engagement altitude has increased from 27 to 32 kilometers.
The great achievement, which has been made as a result of the production of Bavar 373, aside from its defensive goals, is that this project has institutionalized the path of developing anti-aircraft air defense system inside the country. It means that we're now highly capable of producing any form of anti-air defense system inside the country with the help of our own universities, startup companies, and Iranian youth and specialists. By using Bavar 373 missile system, we can counter different types of missiles, bombers, and ballistic missiles.
The Bavar air defense system employs 3 different types of missiles to hit targets at various altitudes. It's been able to hit targets just 5 minutes after fire at an altitude of 43,000 feet.
Iran maintains that its military might poses no threat to regional countries, stressing that the Islamic Republic's defense doctrine is entirely based on deterrence. Saman Kujurip, Tehran.
Supporters of former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan blocked the key avenues and roads leading towards country's capital Islamabad, causing massive traffic jams, halting logistics, and forcing schools and offices to close. Khan, who is demanding immediate elections, survived the assassination attempt last Thursday in the eastern Punjab province, leaving him wounded along with his several party workers. Police have arrested the suspected shooter and registered a case against him. However, Imran Khan and his supporters are not satisfied with it, demanding that Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, Interior Minister Rana Sanaullah, and a senior military official be investigated through a UN inquiry for their alleged involvement in the attack.
There's only one national leader whose name is Imran Khan. Everybody is behind him. We want free and fair investigation under United Nations investigation process.
The masses on the streets were urged due to the violent protest and road closures, asking